You're listening to Sports Connections with David Smale, the show that brings you a fun and intimate look into connections throughout sports. Now here's your host, David Smale.
My guest today is Gordon Docking. Gordon had a couple of very successful but different careers. He began as a sports television reporter and anchor, and then seamlessly transitioned into the world of hospital administration. While it might not seem like a logical move, the skills he learned as a professional communicator served him well in the new world of healthcare, where a lot of really smart people had difficulty in communicating with each other. Gordon, it is a pleasure to welcome you to Sports Connections.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Good to see you.
Good to see you too. Just talk a little bit about your start in journalism, how you became a sports journalist.
Well, I always had interest in journalism. Even going back into high school, and then when I got into college, I had to pick a major, and journalism was really the only thing I considered, because that's just kind of how I had always planned that I would take my career. I thought maybe I'd go to law school, but I can have a journalism degree and go to law school. So that was what I was talking about. I just want to let you know, every 15 minutes, that clock's going to go off. So
that's great.
So we may just have to pause. But I went to journalism school and started off like everybody does, with an emphasis in the print area. And I wound up migrating over into the broadcast journalism part of the school. And really the last 2 years spent my time there. I worked on the student radio station. I did some television production work, but the radio work was the majority of what I did. And I really liked it. And I decided this is what I want to do for a career.
When did we say caught the bug. When did you realize that this was what you wanted to do?
Well, that's an easy question to answer, because it was without question the summer between my junior and senior years of college, when I had a summer internship at KCKN Radio in Kansas City, Kansas. And it was a country music radio station, but they had a very aggressive and active news division. And I started out just as an intern and doing intern type stuff. And before the summer was over, even as an intern, they had me doing a few newscasts on the weekends, or maybe in the middle of the day when the audience was smaller. But I learned so much. And the main thing I learned was to write a newscast every single time, and don't just write stories and then shuffle the stack and do that, those same stories again, but write a different newscast every hour. So it was fresh and try to make it even a little entertaining and not just reading the news. We had a great news team there, headed up by Mike Shannon, who was our news director. Mike's still involved all these years later in the news scene in Kansas City. And it was just an honor and a privilege. And after the internship was over, they actually offered me a part-time job. And so in the fall, I would do weekend newscasts. And then during the second semester of my senior year, they offered me a full-time job before I even graduated. Mm. And that turned into my last semester, I managed to get all of my classes on Tuesday and Thursday, and Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, I was working at the radio station.
Okay. And then you transitioned into TV in Springfield.
Right. I had a part-time gig at Channel 9, just doing the cut-ins during Good Morning America for a couple of months, and filled in on sports on a couple of weekends. But that led to a full-time job at a fantastic television station in Springfield, Missouri. It's nationally a great station and has a fantastic reputation. And that's where I learned to be a television journalist, where I learned to think like a journalist and shoot camera, edit tape, anchor news, report news, anchor sports, report sports. I did everything there but the weather. And if they'd asked me to do it, I'd have probably been the world's worst weatherman. But it was a great experience, and I had 2 great years there, and we made some great friends while we were in Springfield. But that set me up for coming back to Kansas City and the job offer I got to be sports full-time at WDAF.
Now, I know that we've talked before, and I know that you had a mentor there in Springfield. Just talk about the importance of having a mentor, somebody who's willing. You know, we talked a lot in Kansas City about Alex Smith and his influence on Patrick Mahomes. Talk about how important it is in any field, but especially something as it looks so easy, but we know it's not, as being a television sportscaster, having a mentor in Springfield, how important that is.
Well, I got to work with a sportscaster down in Springfield named Ned Reynolds, who's legendary. And he's recently retired now, but he is still the most famous person in Springfield, Missouri. You know, he did sports at KY3 for probably more than 40 years. And was also the voice of Southwest Missouri State and then Missouri State football and basketball. And I got to learn a lot from him. And then when I came to Kansas City, I got to work with some great people too. The weekend anchor team when I started, Phil Witt and Gail King were the news anchors. And, you know, Phil had a great career and was an incredibly talented journalist, and things have worked out pretty well for Gail. She's on CBS Morning News now. And just to have the opportunity to work with the two of them, and then the other people like Denny Treese and Frank Bowl, and you know, just veterans, you know, that taught me so much. There's always somebody there to teach you something if you're willing to ask questions and listen. And as journalists, we're trained in asking questions, so that it's not that hard a thing to do.
That's right. That's right. Now, you were at WDAF for 12 years before moving into hospital administration. Just talk about some of your highlights of the 12 years at WDAF.
Well, there were some good ones. Right before I got there, I did cover the 1980 World Series for KY3 in Springfield, and that helped transition me into the Kansas City sports scene, because I started in December of 1980. I got to cover the Royals during their heyday and their 1985 World Series championship, and including traveling to cover the games in Toronto for the American League Championship Series, and then St. Louis for the World Series. And that was exciting, and to be in the locker rooms after those games and to personally witness the celebration that took place was fascinating and exciting at the same time. I got to cover the fall and rise of the Kansas City Chiefs, some terrible Chiefs teams and Chiefs seasons during the Marv Levy and John Makovic eras. And then when they hired Marty Schottenheimer and Carl Peterson to kind of restore the Chiefs to some form of better football, got to cover the rise of the Chiefs and got to know the people involved and spent a lot of time at Arrowhead and be around people like Derek Thomas and Neil Smith and Marty Schottenheimer and Steve DeBerg, who is one of the funniest people that I've ever been around in my professional career. He was a crack up, and just to be around other colleagues like Len Dawson, who was the anchor of Channel 9, and Don Fortune and Jack Harry, other veterans, I could just pick their brains and learn from them and learn how to be a better sportscaster myself.
Now, I know journalists are supposed to put their personal biases aside, but you also had the opportunity to cover the 1988 NCAA championship at Kemper Arena. And I can't remember who won that one, but there was a personal connection there that had to be difficult for you not to just start waving a flag, wasn't it?
Well, I did try to take my professional responsibility of impartiality seriously. But on that one particular moment when University of Kansas won the NCAA championship at Kemper Arena in 1988, I remember doing a live shot right afterwards outside the arena. And it was hard not to, to bleed a little crimson and blue at that point, especially since I was on the swim team during my time there. I was a sports fan. I was a KU letterman. I was invested in the Jayhawks personally, and it was very exciting for them to win that championship. And it was maybe more exciting for me to have a press row seat to watch it unfold too.
Sure. And you mentioned one of the one of the key roles or the key things that a journalist has to know how to do is ask questions. I want you to tell a story before we move into the next area of your career. Maybe one of the things that a journalist has to know is when not to ask a question, or at least not to ask permission. Tell that story.
Yes. This was during the Bo Jackson era with the Kansas City Royals. And, Bo had injured his hip badly playing football for the Raiders and had to have a hip replacement and was trying to come back with an artificial hip and play baseball for the Royals. And Bo was working very hard with a physical therapist and was doing pool therapy. Mm-hmm. And the Royals were not allowing any video of any of his therapies, and they weren't allowing any interviews with Bo Jackson. Well, our news director, Channel 4, typically we had always covered spring training wall to wall, but because of budget issues and this particular season, we weren't going to go to spring training at all. Well, he came back to the sports department and said, with what's going on with Bo Jackson, we're going to send one person down to Florida to get the definitive story on Bo Jackson, who's not doing any interviews and they're not allowing any video, and you got 1 week, and if it doesn't happen, that person's fired. And then he decided, I'm the one who's going. So
congratulations.
Yeah, lucky me. So we went down there, and on the first day, and I've covered spring training before and I know the drill, and they're at Baseball City, outside of Orlando, where there was an amusement park and a baseball stadium, and, mm-hmm. and that's where the Royals were having spring training. And on the campus, there was a dormitory where the Royals housed one of their minor league teams. And it was a V-shaped building with a fence around it and a swimming pool in the middle of the V. I'll come back to that.
Okay.
But I'm in the locker room. I asked for interview Bo, wasn't allowed. So I interviewed the manager and the trainer and a couple of players and the general manager and the team doctor was there, got all of these interviews done. And then the players went to the field to start workout. Well, Bo didn't go. Bo was there. And we're allowed to be in the locker room, but not in the trainer's room. And Bo's in the trainer's room lifting weights on the Universal Gym. So we can't go in there, but the door was open. And we can stand in the locker room, and if it's in our field of vision, we're allowed to shoot that. So I told my photographer, stand here and shoot Bo lifting weights until they come and close the door. And it took about 30 to 45 seconds. Bo put the weights down, yelled to the photographer, somebody came and closed the door. And we've got about 45 seconds of video that nobody else in America has of Bo working out.
Mm-hmm.
So now, instead of going to the field where the rest of the team is, we know Bo's heading over to that pool at the dormitory. So we didn't ask permission. We just went and found an open door and walked in and went to the second level and found an empty dormitory room and went in and set up a tripod. And Bo shows up a little while later and we shoot the entire 1 hour therapy session in the pool with the physical therapist. Then we go back to our hotel room where our editing equipment is, and we put our stories together and send it all back. I have the definitive story on Bo Jackson with video of him lifting weights, video of him doing his physical therapy that nobody has seen in America. Our video is on Tom Brokaw's NBC National News that night.
So you kind of subtly introduced it to the world.
I'm the lead story locally, not the lead story of sports, the lead story of news at 5 o'clock and 6 o'clock and 10 o'clock. And needless to say, I did not get fired, and my job was safe for a while. And now we've got 6 more days at spring training just to cover baseball, because we're down there for a week.
Mm-hmm.
So I show up in the locker room the next morning, and the Royals public relations director seeks me out and is just reading me the riot act. And I said, Dean, you never told me I couldn't do this. Well, and he starts yelling at me more because I knew if I asked permission that he would tell me no.
Right.
So I didn't ask. I just went and did my job. And took a little heat for it from the Royals, but not from my bosses. And things worked out just fine.
Okay. So in 1992, WDAF had to downsize like a lot of stations at the time, and you got caught up in that. And so you went to the very logical next step for a television broadcaster, and you went into hospital administration. Just real quickly talk about how that happened, but also how your training as a journalist helped you in what a 25-year career as a hospital administrator. That's pretty impressive.
Well, it's not a typical career path, that's for sure. I wanted to stay in the Kansas City area for personal family reasons that we'll get into a little later on. But the CEO, and I've been looking in and out of the TV business because I was looking for a job so family could stay in the Kansas City area.
Right.
And the CEO at St. Joseph Medical Center in Kansas City wanted more media focus on his hospital. And he and I got connected. And he wound up offering me the job. He says, I don't need someone who knows healthcare. I need somebody who knows the media. And if it's the right person, I can teach healthcare to that person. And so I got hired. And we worked real hard to get more media attention at St. Joseph Medical Center. We had an unfortunate tragedy that happened in my first year in that role. And we were one of the co-owners of the Life Flight Air Ambulance Service. And there was a helicopter crash and the pilot died, the patient died, and the paramedic and the flight nurse were both badly injured. And it was a national news story. And I was very involved in helping to coordinate our message to the media. And we co-owned the program along with St. Luke's. And we had joint meetings of the leadership of both St. Joseph and St. Luke's hospitals. But we had all of the news conferences at St. Joseph, where the Life Flight was headquartered. And in retrospect, the CEO liked the way we handled this tragedy. And I wish to heck that it had never happened, but it did. I think the CEO started to see me in a little bit of a different light after that. And I know at my first annual review, he told me, he says, I think you've got a long career in this business and not just in marketing and PR, but I think you could have a good career in hospital administration, but this is a degree oriented business and you need to get your master's degree in hospital administration. And because of that, I quickly explored some schools and wound up going to school at night eventually getting my degree in hospital administration and staying on and getting my MBA as well with an emphasis in healthcare. And a year after I started the program, he moved me out of the PR marketing business and put me into an operations job. And my career just started advancing from that point. On the administrative side, it wasn't what I sought.
Right.
It was never part of my plan, but sometimes a calling finds you instead of you finding it. And that's what happened to me in this case.
Yeah, absolutely true. And you and I've talked before about this, how your ability to ask questions and ability to listen to answers, all things that come very naturally or maybe not naturally, but with training in journalism, how that helped you resolve conflicts between two people who arguably probably both were smarter than you, but couldn't figure out how to communicate to each other. Just talk a little bit about that.
Well, the light bulb on that went off for me when I was having a conversation with one of the nursing administrators at St. Joseph that they were considering me for a promotion. Into a pretty big job. And I was talking to her about it. And I just asked her, I said, Denise, is this something that you think I can do? And because, you know, this is so far removed from what I was doing 4 or 5 years before when I was telling people who won ball games for a living. Mm-hmm. And she looked at me and said, just keep asking your questions. You have a great skill at being able to ask questions and hone in on the critical issues and to drill down that way. So by being a journalist and using my journalist skills, it was helping me to be more effective in the healthcare world. And, you know, I wasn't embarrassed. Sometimes people don't want to ask questions because they don't want to pretend they don't know something.
Right.
I think people just assumed I didn't know.
Yeah.
But I just asked questions and it wasn't something that I was consciously doing, but it was something that was noticed by others. Mm-hmm. Because she said, it's kind of become your management style, is to ask questions and to hone in on the issues and then to help us all get to the answers. And so that helped me greatly. I don't know if that answered the question you were directly asking, but.
Yeah, it did. And it really leads to my last question, and we'll stop talking about your jobs. But even when you did know the answers, even when you did, you were the CEO, you retired as CEO in a couple of different hospitals, but one of your skills that people commented about was your ability to deal with the patients and the parents of the patients and people going through difficult times because you knew how to ask questions. And you were not the typical hospital CEO who sits in his office and makes decisions and pushes pencils and counts beans and all those things. You were very active with that.
I was. I believed in the philosophy that I didn't invent, but it was something I studied and believed in called rounding for outcomes. And I felt I was a lot more effective if I'm out and about in the hallways, talking to the staff, talking to the doctors, talking to the patients, finding out what's on their mind, what's bothering them, what do they need, and can I help you to get, if there's something you need but don't have, can I help you to get it?
Yeah.
Make your job better. And I always had a clipboard with me, and I'd be asking questions and taking notes and then try to hold myself accountable to be able to come back and let them know, you asked me about this, you talked to me about this, and here's what we did.
Yeah.
And I just always tried to close the loop on things, and it seemed to make a difference. And it didn't matter whether I was talking to, someone who worked in the cafeteria or a surgeon back in our operating room, the questions were the same.
Right.
And believe it or not, the answers were often very similar too.
Now, I'm going to transition a little bit to your personal life, and you alluded to it earlier, so we're going to get to that. But one of the things that I think helped you with that, with understanding what patients are going through, happened in February of 1983. Just tell that story and how that impacted you.
Well, my wife and I had our second child. It was March.
March, sorry.
And my daughter was born in February of 81, and my son was born in March of 83. And much to our surprise, but a week after he was born, our doctor called, and Blake was pretty sick and had been in the NICU at the hospital. And the doctor asked if Susan and I could meet with him. And so we came up and met with him and Blake's nurse, and they talked about wanting to do a test, a chromosome test, because he wanted to test for Down syndrome. Well, this had never occurred or never been brought up, never been mentioned. And I didn't know what it was. Susan did, but I didn't know what it was. I don't know that I'd ever seen a human being with Down syndrome. And we had a nice long talk, and it was very confusing. But they said there's a mother here in the hospital who just had a baby and has a 3-year-old with Down syndrome at home, and she would very much like to talk to you. And so after we met with the doctor and talked to the nurse, they took us down to talk to this lady, and she helped us so much. She told us, I mean, she was living what we were about to start, mm-hmm. and was able to tell us things that everything's going to be fine. It's not what you're planning, but you need to go meet this person. You need to go see this place. And she helped us to get us pointed in the right direction, which we needed, because there were no Down syndrome resources in the Kansas City area. There was no Down Syndrome Guild. There was no First Downs for Down Syndrome organization. There were a couple of places where toddlers and babies and young children with Down syndrome could get therapy, but they weren't specific for Down syndrome. But it was just a very confusing and trying time. But it was a very much a learning experience. And I know I reflected when I worked in the hospital, I would reflect back on these moments a lot, mm-hmm. because it was just those difficult conversations that have to take place in a hospital from time to time. And being on the receiving end of one made you think, when you're on the other side of it, you know, how compassionate, how caring do you have to be? And I think helped make me a more effective communicator, made me a more effective leader in a hospital because of the experiences that we'd lived in our real life.
Now, you immediately, maybe not willingly, but you immediately went to work. You said there were no resources for families with a child with Down syndrome, but you immediately went to work to get things in place to help Blake and kids like him, and to help you and Susan and people like you. It became your life calling, helping people with special needs, didn't it?
It really did. And in all fairness, it wasn't me. It wasn't just Susan. It was probably more Susan than me at the beginning. So there were no resources. But I was on TV at the time and was a bit of a known person. And about 4 weeks, 6 weeks after Blake was born, 6 weeks after Blake was born, we got a call from our nurse at the hospital saying we've had another baby born with Down syndrome and the parents are struggling and asking a lot of questions. Can you come up and meet with them? Well, we were armed with 6 weeks of experience. yeah. And we did come up and meet with them. And those people are friends to this day. And they became leaders in the Down syndrome community as well. And their daughter and my son Blake work at the same place now. So it's a small world. But 4 weeks later, we got a call from another hospital. And then a little later, we got a call from a third hospital and then a fourth. And now we're getting calls from all over the city when babies are being born with Down syndrome. And Susan has really put together a packet of information, and she's going around and doing all of these meetings to meet with these parents and to give them the same experience we had with the woman who was at the hospital that they mm-hmm. took down for us to meet with, because she helped us so much. And we thought everybody should have this experience. And I'll be honest, it was therapeutic for us as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But to this day, we'll run into somebody and they'll say, I remember when you came and met with us. Mm. And they're usually talking to Susan, but
yeah.
But it was very helpful. And so we did this for over a year. And then we got together with some other parents. Larry and June Rouse were the leaders of this. And ironically, we just had dinner with them about a month ago. And they had this idea that there should be an organization in the Kansas City area to serve the needs of people like us, people who just had babies with Down syndrome and need some resources and need some guidance. And we were putting this organization together. They wanted to call the Down Syndrome Guild of Kansas City. And that organization exists to this day and has grown and has helped countless thousands of people and families over the years. But Susan and I worked with Larry and June, and we were original board members for the Down Syndrome Guild. And the first official program that the Guild offered was new parent visits to hospitals.
Wow.
Which was taking the program that Susan had been doing on her own and and formalizing that, and that program exists to this day. And if there's a baby born in a hospital in Kansas City, the Down Syndrome Guild takes a basket to those parents that has all kinds of stuff in there that's fun, but also informative to help them get their lives started in the right direction from the time they leave that hospital.
And there's one other thing that you guys, that you helped start with your background with sports and your connection with the Chiefs, and that's the First Downs for Down Syndrome, which is now part of the Down Syndrome. It was separated for a while, now it's back with the Down Syndrome Guild. Just right. Talk about your idea with getting that thing going.
Well, Larry Rouse and I were talking, and the Guild was really good at program as it was growing and evolving. And as our kids were getting older, we're starting programs for not just babies, but toddlers, and then you know kindergarten age kids. And,
right.
But what we found was the Guild was terrible at raising money. And so Larry and I started talking, and Gene Stallings, who was the football coach of the Phoenix Cardinals at the time, had a son with Down syndrome. And he had a program there in Phoenix called First Downs for Down Syndrome that had failed. Well, we were able to get our hands on the ring binder of documents related to the formation in Phoenix of what they tried to do. And we studied it and made a lot of changes and put together a plan and went to the Chiefs and said, here's what we'd like to do. And the Chiefs said, this all looks really good. We wanted to partner with the offensive line because nobody ever worked with the offensive line. They weren't famous people, but they were good guys, rock solid guys. And the Chiefs liked that concept as well. Said, you have to go raise $20,000. And if you can raise $20,000, we'll know you're legit. And so Larry and I went out and we started raising money and went to J.E. Dunn Construction and the local Kansas City Chevy dealers and some other places. And we got four companies to donate $5,000 a piece. And we went back to the Chiefs and said, you're in business. And partnered with the Chiefs for a long, long time and developed very special relationships with Tim Grunhardt and John Tate and Casey Wigman and Brian Waters and Will Shields and a few other linemen as well along the way. But the offensive line was always very appreciative of the fact that we wanted to work with them. And because of that, they got involved in our organization as well. And it was very exciting. We raised a ton of money. We had a golf tournament and a wine auction and a walk, which was huge. And we got to the point where we were raising over $500,000 with our walk. But fundraising is limited. When you're fundraising by special event, you're limited to what those events can raise. And so most of our money that we raised went to the Down Syndrome Guild, but some went to the Down Syndrome Clinic at Children's Mercy and a couple of other Down Syndrome related organizations in the Kansas City area. But we're talking to the Guild, and the Guild is becoming more savvy now too. And there's grant opportunities that we can't go after because we don't offer services. We just raise money.
Yeah.
And so it seemed to make sense that we can bring First Downs for Down Syndrome and the Down Syndrome Guild back together into one organization. So the fundraising is being also done by the organization that provides the services, so they can still have their special events, but can now go after the grants. And it was a good strategic time to bring the two organizations back together. I was just down at the office just very recently, and it's just great to see all the programs and the services, and, you know, started out doing work for babies and now they're providing services for adults with Down syndrome, and the growth that they've had over the years has just been phenomenal. And to be honest, it kind of warms my heart to know that because of Blake, there's a small piece of Blake in all of the work that they're doing down there.
And it's interesting. I had a chance to talk to Tim Grunhardt recently, and he says of all the things that he's done in his NFL career, playing in the Pro Bowl, paving the way for 1,000-yard rushers, being a part of First Downs for Down Syndrome is the highlight for him. So that's really cool. Now, you mentioned Blake. I want you to tell a little bit about Blake. Let's first of all talk about Blake's personality.
Well, he is always happy, always, perpetually. And I've never seen him sad. You know, I kind of think he almost doesn't have that sadness gene in him. Mm-hmm. But he loves his sports. He gets up in the morning and the first thing he wants to know, who's KU playing today? Well, it's not today, it's tomorrow, and who are they playing? And, you know, he kind of taught himself to read through PlayStation, and he can read all of the college teams' logos and spell Oklahoma and Syracuse because of PlayStation. It's kind of how he's kind of the way he's learned. But he's just a kind, good-hearted young man who's a giant sports fan.
And it's interesting, you talked about him being a big KU fan. And I'm going to get in a second here, we'll get into the book that you wrote. And it's called Blake and Me, The Life Lessons I've Learned from the Best Teacher I Ever Had. And we'll let you talk about that in a minute. But transition into that, one of the life lessons that you learned as a journalist was through Blake, not necessarily rooting the way you wanted to do. So tell that story.
Oh, this goes way back to the Danny Manning days of KU, which is that 88 team that won the national championship. And University of Missouri was pretty good back then too. And they had a guy named Derek Chivas, who was an All-American type player himself. And Blake and I, I'm off the clock. I'm at home. And Blake and I are watching KU play Mizzou on TV. And it's a tight game like those games always were. And KU would score a basket and go ahead, and I'd be cheering and Blake would be cheering. And then Derek Chivas would go back the other way and slam one home. And I'd be going, oh man. And Blake would be cheering again. Trying to plan. No, this is not.
That's the bad guys.
That's not what we do. So KU goes down and they score again. And then Mizzou goes back and they score, and Blake's cheering again. And I started watching him almost more than I'm watching the game. And what I learned from him is he's just cheering for the good plays. Didn't matter who made him. He, you know, maybe he just doesn't like defense and he only likes offense. and when he plays Special Olympics basketball, there's a lot of truth in that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I learned that maybe I shouldn't get so emotionally invested in each and every play like I can tend to do, because Blake was sitting there just enjoying the game more than I was, because he was enjoying the good plays regardless of who made them. So I learned a little from my baby son or infant son way back in the day in 1988.
So you took some of these stories, and I had the privilege of helping you or working with you on this. You took some of these stories that are all sports related. You know, you and I share a sports background that taught you life lessons. Just talk about what pushed you to do this book and what you hope to gain from this book.
Well, I've felt like I've had this book in me for a long time, and I'd even talked to a couple of my friends about it. And one of them in particular, this may be where you're going with this, a friend of mine named Kim started harassing me about not starting the book. And I would see him and he'd say, got that first chapter written yet? No, pretty much know what I'm going to say, but you haven't. Anyway, this went on for several years. And then I finally decided, well, it's time to actually get something going. I got in touch with you through a mutual friend, and we sat down and started working on this, and I let Kim know. He was skeptical.
He's from Missouri. Show me, right?
He says, I'll believe it when I see it. Well, I didn't have anything to show him yet, but a few months later we did, and he was appreciative enough that he wound up writing a little bit of a review that's on the back cover of the book for me. And he knows Blake very well and is a dear, dear family friend. But I appreciated the nudge that he gave me over a number of years to finally stop procrastinating and start getting to work on this book.
And I'm going to let you tell some of your favorite life lessons that you've learned. One of my favorites, speaking of Kim, is stop practicing and start playing. And, you know, we spend so much time preparing for excellence that we often don't have time for excellence when we're all through preparing. So tell the story of Kim and your other golfing buddy and as it relates to Blake.
Well, Blake, who's a pretty good golfer, and Kim and I are playing golf and Mike, a fourth friend, and we're in Richland, Missouri, which is Kim's hometown. Now, he lives in the Kansas City area now, but we're back in his hometown playing golf. And Kim is notorious, although I will say he plays a lot faster now than he did back then, but he was a very slow golfer and took numerous practice swings. Blake is the world's fastest golfer. And the next practice swing he takes will be the first one he's ever taken. And he just walks up and hits the ball. And so our fourth friend, Mike, we get to the 18th tee and Mike's been harassing Kim about how deliberate he is and how long it's taken him to play this round of golf. And he says, why don't you just get up like Blake and just step up, put the ball on the tee and hit it. And so Kim, by the 18th tee, finally had enough and he teed it up and he looked at Mike and said, fine. And he just teed it up, no practice swing, hit the ball, and it was the best shot he hit all day. and now Mike is really giving him the business. You see, Blake is teaching you how to play golf. So that was the lesson there that Kim learned, and is that quit procrastinating and just play.
What are some of your favorite life lessons that we shared in the book that you learned from Blake?
Well, I'll talk about two. And the first one's a fun one. Blake, before the pandemic, used to bowl every Thursday. And I'm sure when the world is normal again, they will be bowling every Thursday again. And he's a pretty good bowler. I've seen him bowl a 180. He always breaks 100. But this particular day, and this was a few years ago, he was doing something wrong. And the ball was going into the left-hand gutter about 10 or 15 feet out of his hand every single time. And he got to the 10th frame, second ball, and he has a score of 0. And I'm there watching, and he's frustrated, and I'm unbelievably frustrated. And Blake rolls that last ball, and it's drifting left and drifting left, but it just hangs on and clips that back corner pin and knocks it down. And Blake whirls around, throws his arms in the air and goes, got one. And he's celebrating a bowling score of 1. And it took me a while to kind of come to grips with what was happening there, because I'm sitting there thinking, man, he bowled a 1.
Right.
And Blake is going, I got one. It was incremental improvement. And he'd thrown all those balls before and had nothing. And on this last one, he got one and he was genuinely happy.
Yeah.
And okay. So what I learned there is just lighten up a little bit and appreciate the incremental improvement in whatever you're doing. And that's what Blake was doing. And I think about that quite often.
And you said you had a second one.
Yeah. Blake has got involved with an Episcopal church through his friends and some leadership with the Olathe, Kansas Special Olympics program. And I had kind of fallen out of the church-going mode back when I was in college and was not a church-goer. And, you know, I considered myself a faithful person and a Christian, but didn't attend church and wasn't a church goer and didn't have any affiliation with the church. And about 5 years ago, I was having some health problems And Blake was attending this church in the I'd attended it a few times with him and Susan and the priest there. I was going to have a pretty big surgery, and he said, "If you like, I'd be happy to come down to the hospital and pray with you before you go back to the operating room." And you know, my honest answer was, "What can it hurt?" Sure. And he came down and we had a conversation and it was nice. And then 6 months later, I had some other health issues and he was involved in talking to me and helping me through some of that. And it just made me want to get more involved with this church, because it seemed like a community of people that were really good people. And I was enjoying and liked what I was seeing, and I liked what it did for Blake. And so I did get involved with this church, and actually as an adult was formally baptized for the first time in my life. And it's all because of Blake. Blake was the one who led me there. Mm-hmm. And it was a very tremendous thing for one of my daughter was involved in something very similar to this too, because despite my shortcomings as a parent in the world of religion, both of my kids found their way to church. Really started with my daughter, Kelly. Blake saw that, he wanted to get involved in a church. And so really it was starting with Kelly through Blake, led to me, and it was my kids who taught me the lesson there, that there's some real benefit and some goodness in this experience, and I look forward to it. We're attending parking lot services now,
right?
And the church has a little radio frequency. It's 89.7 or something like that, and we go sit in the church parking lot and turn the radio on, and they bring communion to the car. But Blake is the one who's made this happen for me, along with Kelly, and I'm forever appreciative to the both of them for making that happen.
And to take things full circle, I think it's partly because of your background in journalism, where you don't have your story written ahead of time. You're willing to listen, you're willing to learn from what you're covering in the case of journalism, and in this case, you're willing to learn from your kids that there is something out there besides what were your passions before.
Well, I think there's probably a lot of truth to that. I really do.
All right. Well, we'll wrap this up. Just tell people where they can get a copy of your book. I'm a little biased, but I think it's a great book. And there it is.
Right here.
Well, a little higher so we can see the title.
There, okay. It's called Blake and Me. You can see the life lessons I've learned from the best teacher I ever had. And at the top, it does say Gordon Docking with David Smail. So I am very appreciative, David, of the help you've given me on that. We were very aggressively marketing and selling the book, and then the pandemic happened and kind of shut it down for a while. When the world gets back to normal, I'll relaunch it like it's a new book again. But my website is still up and active, and if anybody who sees this is interested in acquiring the book, you can get an autographed copy if you buy one through my website, and it's gordondocking.com. It's just GordonDocking.com. And I'll get a message on there, and I'll be happy to send you an email or send you a book right away, and it'll be a signed copy.
All right. Sounds good. Gordon, I appreciate your time. It's always good to catch up with you. Great job on the book. Great job with the career. And basically, if we can diagram your life in one sentence, it's all about paying it forward. So I thank you very much for being here, and you have a great afternoon.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Sports Connections with David Smail. Make sure to subscribe, follow, and rate the show from your favorite podcast platform. You can learn more about David Smail and his work by visiting davidsmailbooks.com. Don't forget to join us weekly for new episodes. Until next time.